Assange's friends hadn't been as careful as he had. The third member of the International Subversives, a hacker who went by the handle Prime Suspect, couldn't use Trax's untraceable calling method due to a difference in a telephone exchange connected to his home. And as Underground tells it, he had been tracked on Nortel's network on the same fateful night that the network administrator had played cat and mouse with Assange. Prime Suspect breached its firewall during the thin window of time between when Assange had escaped, but before he could call his fellow hackers to warn them that he had tipped off the telecom's security. In the end, it didn't matter. Trax himself had called up the cops and, almost accidentally, turned himself in. The teen hacker had long been unstable, agoraphobic, and unfit for the immense pressure of illegal hacking. When he called up the police to report a death threat against him by another hacker, he found himself inexplicably confessing his own activities, and soon those of his friends. The Australian justice system took nearly 3 years to bring charges against Assange, and two more before he was sentenced. The judge, in the end, was lenient, recognizing that Mendax had never intended to profit from his hacks, only to idealistically seek a world without limits on information. He was sentenced to a $2,000 fine and a $5,000 bond, depending on his good behavior. But during the intervening 5 years, the possibility of impending jail time meant Assange never felt safe taking a real job or making long-term plans. He fell into a deep depression, first checking himself into a mental hospital and then checking out to spend 6 months on an aimless walkabout, sleeping in the wilderness around Melbourne, frequently waking with his face covered by mosquito bites. Eventually, Assange returned to the city to try and re-engage with the world. He created a computer security firm with Trax, but it fell apart when their lead investor faced credit problems. He began volunteering for non-profit organizations, lending his computer expertise. He even worked with police in the city of Victoria, helping them to track and take down child pornography rings in two separate cases. But he drew the line at helping to catch his fellow hackers. "I couldn't ethically justify that," he's quoted as saying in Underground. "But as for others, such as people who prey on children or corporate spies, I am not concerned about using my skills there." Assange took a job as systems administrator at an Australian internet service provider, ISP, called Suburbia, that hosted online chats on everything from cryptography to religion. In some ways, he later told me, Suburbia was the prototype for WikiLeaks more than any other project he worked on. Assange says some discussion rooms on Suburbia became forums for discussions among lawyers and activists claiming corrupt practices by the Australian telecom giant, Telstra. But Suburbia also hosted discussions about a topic that would become the ground zero battle for free speech in years to come: Scientology. One of the notoriously censorious religion's critics had been sued under copyright claims and had his computers seized after posting documents on the service. The leaked documents, previously only available to members of the religion who had achieved a certain expensive stature, showed that Scientologists believed in communication with plants. When the ensuing outrage spilled over to Suburbia, American lawyers contacted Assange to question him about one of his customers who had been an outspoken critic, David Girard. Assange, of course, refused and instead alerted Girard. "He had titanium balls," Girard would tell me years later. "We were the free speech ISP in Australia," says Assange. "People were fleeing from ISPs that would fold under legal threats, even from a cult in the U.S. That's something I saw early on without realizing it. Potentiating people to reveal their information, creating a conduit. Without having any other robust publisher in the market, people came to us." Even as he settled into a new life beyond hacking, Assange's charges hung over him like a bitter cloud. Years later, he would compare the feeling, hyperbolically, to Russian dissident writer Oleksandr Solzhenitsyn's imprisonment in Stalin's gulags. "How close the parallels to my own adventures," he wrote in a rather self-pitying 2006 blog entry. Such prosecution in youth is a defining peak experience. To know the state for what it really is. True belief only begins with a jackboot at the door. For an information freedom advocate like Assange, the plight of Phil Zimmerman in the United States, who, like Assange, had the threat of prosecution for seemingly harmless digital crimes hang over him for 3 years, must have felt especially familiar. It's little wonder that he fell in with Zimmerman's most hardcore supporters, the crew who happened to also be radical hackers and anti-authoritarian misfits like himself. Assange became a cypherpunk. He began posting to the mail list under the nickname Prof in 1995. His earliest writings, like most of the conversations on the list, were snarky takedowns of fellow posters' ideas. In his third message, he calls one demanding user a dummy and tells him to get a life. He tells another that some research is in order before you go shooting off your mouth, and then makes fun of a third for hosting a party that ends at 10 p.m., calling it an after-school Tupperware get-together. Apropos of nothing, he posts a list of National Security Agency anagrams in another message, including Your Testicle, Again, Nancy, and National Gay Secrecy Unit. But Prof was no mere cynic or jokester. He would eventually use the list to organize a Melbourne protest against Scientology in retaliation for its attempt to censor suburbia. To the church, the battle isn't won in the courtroom, he posted in his anti-Scientology manifesto. It is won at the very moment the legal process starts unfolding, creating fear and expense in those the church opposes. Their worst critic at the moment is not a person or an organization, but a medium, the Internet. The Internet is, by its very nature, a censorship-free zone. He then called on all good cypherpunks to come make their voices heard at the Melbourne Church of Scientology building at 11 a.m. the next day. 11 people showed up. But more important, perhaps, than what Assange wrote on the cypherpunk mailing list was what he and his cohorts read. For the decade that it was active, the list chronicled the long and painful evolution of the cryptographic anonymity that Assange would later harness under WikiLeaks. And that anonymity began, in its most newborn and vulnerable form, with a Finn named Yolf. In 1992, Johan Yolf Helsingius, a co-founder of Finland's biggest internet service provider, had witnessed a strange conversation on a Usenet forum hosted on an academic server. Two users were arguing, and one had taken the pseudonym Jesus. The other, a pretentious academic type, was not amused by this use of a humorous handle, and tried to argue that it was against the rules of the Internet to hide one's identity on a university server, and downright offensive to hide it with a disrespectful nickname. Coming from the growing non-academic side of the net, the notion that one professorial user would try to declare the rules for online identity deeply riled Helsingius. As part of the Swedish-speaking minority group in Finland, Helsingius had a special concern for protecting the rights of marginalized groups and the vulnerable, and felt that anonymity was an important safeguard for those groups. He set out to prove that technology, not pretensions, would define the nature of identity on the Internet. The result was Penet, an anonymous remailer server that ran off a humble PC with a 386 processor in a back room of Yolf's home. Users could send Penet an email along with a designated final destination. In his explanation posted to the Cypherpunk mailing list, he cites Usenet groups devoted to erotic needlework and masturbation as examples. And the message would be relayed on to those endpoints with a newly generated pseudonym. Penet would keep a database of those pseudonyms and the email addresses linked to them, so that if anyone wanted to reply to that handle, it would route back through the server and find the original sender. Penet used none of David Chom's crypto innovations, and Helsingius listed so many possible security vulnerabilities in his introduction to the service that it's a wonder anyone used it at all. He warned that users would have to trust him as the server's administrator, that he might be subpoenaed to give up someone's identity, and even that hackers could break in and steal the data. It wasn't the best, the safest, or the most secure, but it was easy, says Helsingius. That's how I pitched it. And it seems that's what people wanted. Soon, thousands of users, and eventually hundreds of thousands, were routing their secrets through Pennet, enough traffic that Helsingius was paying more than $10,000 a month in bandwidth. I could have bought some expensive golf clubs instead, I suppose. But no hobbies are free, and this was something I believed in, Helsingius says. For much of the early 90s, Pennet became the best-known anonymity service in the world, channeling discussions ranging from sexual abuse to homosexuality to religious freedom to whistleblowing, along with a load of spam, insults, and flame wars. And Helsingius became a cypherpunk regular and Nordic king of the remailers. And then in 1995, Helsingius received an email very much like the one that was sent to Assange at Suburbia. It was from the Scientologists. The lawyer of the Religious Technology Center, which held the copyright on Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard's work, was requesting that Helsingius block all messages from Pennet to the Usenet group on Scientology, which contained equal parts followers and critics of the movement, on the grounds that Pennet users were posting copyrighted Scientology materials to the forum. Helsingius refused, of course. A month later, he got a call. It was the Scientologists again, and this time they told him they had reported a burglary to the LA police and the FBI. Their copyrighted material, they argued, had been stolen via Helsingius' data laundering service by one user with the Pennet pseudonym AN144108. 6 days later, the Finnish police arrived with a warrant. Helsingius fought the legal battle for more than a year, but Finnish law wasn't ready for the internet. A postman was legally protected from having to reveal the secrets of the letters he delivered. But a virtual carrier like Helsingius still had no shield from legal orders that require he snitch on his clients. And when it became clear that he could either do just that or go to jail, Helsingius caved. He told the Helsinki court that AN144108 was linked to an alumni account at Caltech. And as the Scientologists moved on to harassing Caltech's administrators for the username, Helsingius decided to shut down the service. Pennet had gone from a symbol of freedom of speech to a honey trap for exposing exactly the people he had hoped to protect. When the Church of Scientology won, I knew that would have opened the floodgates for anyone to try the same attack, he says. So I pulled the plug. Pennet had stuck a toe in the water of the anonymous internet, and it had come back a bloody stump. Did Assange, who no doubt followed the issue on the Cypherpunk mailing list, learn something from the saga of Yolf? I'm sure he got a few ideas, Helsingius says cheerfully, about exactly how not to do things. At the Village Pizza Shop, as they were sitting down to consume a pepperoni, Dorothy asked Jim, "So what other inventions are you working on?" Jim replied, "I've got a new idea. Literally revolutionary." "Okay, Jim, which government are you planning to overthrow?" she asked, playing along. "All of them," answered Jim. So begins a passage in an essay by James Dalton Bell, a 10-part, 16,000-word screed that hit the Cypherpunk mailing list in 1997 like a provocateur's glove slap across the face. It was called Assassination Politics. And like Tim May's Blacknet, it would mix cypherpunk raw materials into an elaborate imaginary engine that would agitate the list's conversation for years. Unlike May, however, Bell wasn't just rehearsing a thought experiment. He hoped, and in fact still believes, that his system would someday be implemented. Nor was assassination politics an idea that confined its intended effects to mere bits. As its name implied, It was a kind of cypherpunk political institution, and it was engineered for murder. Assassination politics' active ingredient was anonymity, and the cypherpunk drive for untraceable digital pseudonyms had hardly ended with Yolf Helsingius and the demise of Pennet. In fact, long before the Finnish server shutdown, remailers had been evolving well beyond the simple name-for-NIM swapping system that Helsingius had implemented. Instead, they had started to look more and more like the Mix Network idea outlined by David Chom more than a decade earlier, and emulated on the floor of Eric Hughes' house with slips of paper and envelopes at the first Cypherpunks meeting. Multiple remailers sending messages inside nested layers of encryption to prevent anyone from knowing the identities of the sender and recipient, not even the remailers themselves. After Eric Hughes' first stab at a cypherpunk remailer, others had soon improved on his weekend's worth of pearl coding. Hal Finney, a former video game developer who had worked on pieces of PGP, designed a version of the remailer that would integrate Zimmerman's encryption software. Now a message's destination could be encrypted with a remailer's public key. That was the first step toward Chom's ideal. No one snooping on the sender's network could see the message's final destination. And Finney's system allowed remailers to be chained together so that a message could be encrypted with many layers of public keys and slowly unpeeled by one remailer after another until it reached its destination. With a long enough chain of remailers, none of them would be able to connect the endpoint to the source. Cypherpunks, as Eric Hughes had declared, wrote code. Creating was always more admired within the group than theorizing. But it was Lance Cottrell, a PhD student in astrophysics at the University of California, San Diego, who actually took the time to go back to David Chom's papers and read how a mix network was supposed to work. Chom had imagined facing off against an adversary no less resourceful than the cunning NSA. So he had thought many moves ahead. If a spy could see enough of the network, for instance, Chom realized that the spook could watch both ends of a correspondence and recognize a message going in one end and then coming out the other a few moments later. Based on the timing, those messages could be spotted as one and the same. Worse yet, using multiple layers of encryption to route the message through multiple remailers could make a clever snoop's job easier by revealing clues about how many hops remained until the message reached its destination. If a message was wrapped in multiple layers of encryption, it would get substantially larger. And every remailer that stripped away a layer of encryption and sent the message on to its next destination would shrink it down again, providing more accidental hints to anyone trying to trace the source and destination. So Cottrell finally built in the solutions that Chom's genius had long ago prescribed. His remailer program, which he called Mixmaster, delayed the transmission of messages until it had a certain number in reserve, and then sent them out in batches to fool any timing-based attacks. If a remailer didn't receive enough messages to mix them up and disguise their timing, it would even generate fake ones to surround and disguise the real one. To prevent the trick of counting messages' apparent layers of encryption to predict how many hops until their destination, Mixmaster also relayed messages in packets of exactly the same size. If a message ended up too small after some layers of encryption were removed by the first remailers in the chain, the program padded it with junk data. Too big, and it split the message up into equal chunks. The cypherpunks appreciated the rigor of Cottrell's work, and Mixmaster was a hit. Soon it was running on around 2,000 Unix machines around the world, pumping a flow of tens of thousands of anonymous emails a day, as close an approximation to Chom's ideal mix network as ever existed. Meanwhile, anonymous financial transactions were starting to feel like a reality too. Chom's own company, called DigiCash, had implemented many of the ideas he outlined in his Communications of the ACM article. The result was eCash, a cryptocurrency that would allow buyers to wire money untraceably to a seller, In the mid-90s, DigiCash botched a series of deals and replaced Chom with a new CEO before going bankrupt in 1998. But despite its lack of business success, no one doubted that Chom's anonymous transactions technology worked. It had even been integrated into a Dutch toll road system that could reliably charge drivers without recording any trace of their identities. Jim Bell, an engineer and chemist with a round face and large glasses, understood the power of Chom's tools. He had once worked alongside Tim May at Intel, building early solid-state hard drives long before either of them had developed their interest in cryptography. Like May, he was a libertarian to his core. And for both men, in their own ways, the advent of anonymous messaging and anonymous payments represented not just the possibility, but the inevitability of crypto anarchy. Bell's path to that end was just a bit bloodier. Assassination politics plan was simple enough. Anyone could place a bet with a central organization that some specific person would die at a certain time, date, and place. Gamblers would submit their encrypted guesses by email, scrubbed of identifying information by anonymous remailers, and linked with a payment of untraceable digital cash. When a person died, anyone could send in the key to decrypt his or her prediction. And if it turned out that the bet had nailed the exact snuff time of a certain person, the sender collected all the digital cash on the deceased person's head via another untraceable transfer. It would be an encrypted, anonymous, digital Deadpool. Of course, Bell implied with a wink and a nudge, no one could possibly know the date, time, and place of a certain well-known person's death better than the one who caused it. And with a large enough pile of untraceable money riding on someone's head, there would be little doubt that professional killers would get in on the game. Suddenly, Bell imagined, the minority of Americans with strong anti-government leanings would gain incredible power. If only 0.1% of the population, or one person in 1,000, was willing to pay $1 to see some government slimeball dead, that would be, in effect, a $250,000 bounty on his head, Bell wrote. Further, imagine that anyone considering collecting that bounty could do so with a mathematical certainty that he could not be identified and could collect the reward without meeting or even talking to anybody who could later identify him. Perfect anonymity, perfect secrecy, and perfect security. And that, combined with the ease and security with which these contributions could be collected, would make being an abusive government employee an extremely risky proposition. Chances are good that nobody above the level of county commissioner would even risk staying in office. Just how would this change politics in America? It would take far less time to answer. What would remain the same? No longer would we be electing people who will turn around and tax us to death, regulate us to death, and for that matter, send hired thugs to kill us when we oppose their wishes. No military? Bell described global crypto anarchy in rosy terms. Sure, there would be no government to protect American borders or punish crime. But the military would be unnecessary in a world where no foreign government would be able to form a military either. And all aggressive dictators would be immediately eliminated by crypto-funded assassins. Consider how history might have changed if we'd been able to bump off Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo, Kim Il-sung, Ho Chi Minh, Ayatollah Khomeini, Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, and various others, Bell wrote. As for fighting crime, he explained, citizens could pool together money to put out anonymous hits on criminals just as easily as politicians. Assassination politics inflamed the cypherpunk mailing list almost as much as the defunct clipper chip had. You gleefully propose to let us all in on the immoral game of murdering those who annoy us sufficiently, wrote one user through an anonymous remailer. I'll pass. Others won't, Bell responded simply. When one cypherpunk implied that Bell was a loony extremist who thought the government was out to get him, Bell corrected him. I am out to get the government. Another scolded Bell that By resorting to violence, you are no better than the ones you purport to protect us against. Bell answered that assassination politics was only responding in kind to a violation of his own rights. And he shot back the most withering possible question in a mail list populated by libertarians: are you a statist? As for cypherpunk founding father Tim May, he never criticized Bell's morals, only his methods. May, after all, was the one who had called for a thermonuclear cauterization of Washington, D.C., in one essay. But why bother with a silly cover story of predictions, May thought, when anonymity tools could allow the whole assassination market to function in the open? He had predicted online liquidation markets, you slay, we pay, in the email that followed his BlackNet experiment more than 3 years earlier. More important, May felt, Bell lacked discretion. Even attaching his own name to assassination politics made Bell and everyone associated with him a target for the feds. He wasn't paranoid enough in distancing himself from the project, says May. I just stayed away from it. If I got an email from Bell, I dropped it unanswered. I didn't think he was an original thinker, and I didn't want to get involved with his lame-ass idea. Phil Zimmerman, who had always considered the cypherpunks too radical and provocative, felt perhaps the strongest aversion of all to Bell's murderous blueprint. He was so full of violence and anger, Zimmerman says with disgust. At one point, Bell wrote to Zimmerman to ask what the inventor of PGP thought of his ideas. I wrote him back and said that he had managed to do what no one in the U.S. government could ever do. He had made me wonder whether I never should have worked on encryption in the first place.